listening to CPR, communitypublicradio.org. And this is Weekday World. I'm your host, Don DeBar. With a report of some of the news and events of the past 24 hours from the CPR Newsroom. From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. With the firing of another missile by the Democratic People's Republic of Korea, or North Korea, one which apparently can reach the entire continental United States, Thursday's press conference at the Department of State was particularly lively. But it was Thursday's announcement that Secretary of State Rex Tillerson would be leaving at the end of the year that caught the first question for spokesperson Heather Nauert.
Why don't we go right to the elephant in the room? Many of our news organizations are being...
Let me just pause by saying I'm sorry, I have allergies, and so I've got a little bit of a cough today. So
no problem, sure. The White House officials are telling many news organizations represented here that Secretary Tillerson is on his way out. He's going to be replaced by CIA Director Pompeo. Is that accurate? Has the secretary spoken to Trump about this today, and how long does he expect to remain in his role?
Okay, so here's what I can tell you. You saw the White House statement earlier today. The White House statement confirmed that there will be no personnel changes. It is a fact that Secretary Tillerson serves at the pleasure of the president, as we all do, as does every political appointee and cabinet member. Secretary Tillerson enjoys this job. He has a lot of work to do. We started out this morning together, and he had a series of meetings. In addition to his regularly scheduled meetings with Washington officials and phone calls, he had a meeting with a Foreign Minister Gabriel of Germany. The secretary and I spoke at that time. We talked a little bit about Burma. We talked a little bit about the DPRK. The secretary had a successful meeting, which I'd like to get to a little bit later and tell you a little bit about what came out of that bilateral meeting. And then he was off to the White House. We heard about the news. He went off to the White House with a regularly scheduled meeting with Bahrain and the president, returned here for a short while, and then he headed back to the White House for an additional meeting, which was a preset meeting, a small principals group meeting. The topic of that is Syria. The reason I'm telling you about sort of all these comings and goings of the secretary is that he remains as I have been told, committed to doing this job. He does serve at the pleasure of the president. This is a job that he enjoys. He's continuing with his meetings. He's continuing with his calls. He has spoken not only with Foreign Minister Gabriel, but also with the UN Secretary General earlier today. And so he's continuing with a full schedule.
How does he go about doing his job with this hanging over him? I mean, he's going to go off to Europe on Monday. You know, what reason would foreign governments have to believe that he speaks on behalf of President Trump when the White House is letting it be known publicly that they don't have confidence in him anymore?
The secretary is someone whose feathers don't get ruffled very easily. He kind of, you know, brush this off today. He's heard these kinds of stories before. These stories have come up through his tenure here at the State Department, and he's just going on about his business. In terms of how he will handle the meetings next week, he has a very robust schedule. These are matters that he'll be discussing that he is passionate about, from our relationship with the Europeans to NATO and asking various NATO countries for additional commitments in Afghanistan, something we view as being important to addressing the good and solid relationships we have with the European partners. So he has a big agenda. That agenda has certainly not changed. He remains the Secretary of State. As long as he is serving at the pleasure of the president, he will continue to do that job.
But you're not saying that these rumors are groundless. Are you saying that they are completely false and groundless?
Here's what I know. I don't work at the White House, but I can tell you is that the Chief of Staff, Kelly, called our department this morning and said that the rumors are not true, that those reports are not true. That is what I've been told. That's what we've been told. Mm-hmm. And you heard from the White House today that they have no personnel changes to announce.
Wouldn't it be the right thing to do for the White House to issue a statement on the eve of the Secretary's departure on such a major trip to say that these rumors are groundless, that is the case?
I'm not going to tell the White House how to conduct its business. Chief of Staff has spoken to reporters. I believe he did a gaggle earlier today in which he spoke to reporters and said that this report is not true. Sarah Sanders has spoken to reporters as well. I believe she has a briefing a little bit later today. I'm sure many of you want to cover that as well. So I'd have to let the White House speak for itself. From our standpoint here at the State Department, we remain committed to our job. As you saw, Ambassador Birx was here talking about the successes of our global AIDS program, and we're just continuing with business as usual.
Did the Secretary discuss this with the President when he was over at the White House?
Not to my knowledge.
Okay. How do you characterize the chemistry between Secretary Tillerson and Mr. John Kelly?
Between Secretary Tillerson and Secretary Kelly? Or
and
Chief of Staff Kelly?
Chief of Staff.
I was told I was not at the White House today. I was here. I was told that it was normal, the same as usual, that the Secretary was treated the same as he always is. That's what I was told.
Who did John Kelly speak with when he called this morning? And I mean, you said not to your knowledge that there was any discussion between the President and Secretary. So there was no personal assurance during his time over at the White House today?
Again, I was not there, so I hesitate to say too much because I was not there to see it myself. But some of that would be a private, considered private discussions, but I don't believe that conversation took place.
Okay, and the call to this department today?
The call to the department came into the Chief of Staff this morning. There may have been
Margaret Peterlin.
Correct. There may have been subsequent calls that have taken place. If so, if something's happened since we've been in this briefing room, I'm not aware of it. Hi, Kyla.
Hey. Does the Secretary want to keep this job? Does he feel that he's doing a good job? He's come under, incredible pressure from outsiders, from Congress. Does he want to keep the job?
The Secretary is somebody who's unflappable. I mean, you've seen him here before. He's somebody who is committed to his job. He's someone who is very passionate about speaking with world leaders and advancing U.S. foreign policy goals. He continues with his schedule and the schedule that we have put out, and that schedule hasn't changed. So I believe that that is something that he's committed to doing.
Will he fight to keep the job should they decide that they're going to go on with someone else?
That would be just speculation, a hypothetical that I'm not going to get into. Okay.
Does he feel pressure from the White House? I mean, given this leak and we've done this now for a couple months of people at the White House leaking unflattering stories about him and his relationship with the president, does he feel pressure to resign from the White House?
I think what he feels is that Washington can be a tough game of politics. You've heard him reference that before, that he's not from Washington, he's not a person of Washington, and he doesn't always understand and accept exactly how Washington works, with anonymous sources, things of that nature. That's not who he is, that's not the world that he comes from.
Okay. Follow up on that.
Yeah, go right ahead.
How would you characterize his relationship with the president? Some of these reports, it's been reported that it is soured over the last couple of months, mm-hmm. in particular.
Well, certainly they will have areas of disagreement when it comes to policy. I mean, that's no doubt. And that's very clear. The secretary has spoken to that himself and has said, you know, that's part of the reason that the president hired him, so that he could have different opinions being given to the president, and the president could ultimately make his decision on various policy issues. So they have had areas of disagreement when it's come to policy. I know that the president certainly respects Secretary Tillerson. I know that they've had certainly a cordial relationship. Where that relationship is today, I can't speak to that.
Ringing endorsement.
Well, I have not personally been in the room with the secretary and the president at the same time. So there's not too much that I can really say about that, other than the secretary serves at the pleasure of the president, and the secretary had two meetings with the president today. Okay. Go ahead, Nike.
Secretary Tillerson and President have some areas of disagreement on policy.
Well, they have in the past, certainly, on things like climate change and all that. You know that.
Right. Does that also include the latest retweet on the anti-Muslim video? And has the State Department warned the White House that such retweet may cause repercussion?
One of the things we will always say is the safety and security of our American personnel and of U.S. citizens abroad is our top concern. The State Department has continuous conversations with the White House and the National Security Council about anything that could affect any Americans' safety and security abroad. When it comes to specific conversations, you know all too well that I can't comment on our sort of private internal conversations, but it wouldn't be unusual for us to have those kinds of conversations about any matter in the world.
Has the State Department warned the White House such retreat may put the U.S. embassies abroad at risk?
I will tell you again. We have lots of communications with the White House and NSC about a variety of security issues. I don't know that yesterday or today is any different than it was in the past. Okay, Carol, hi.
Did the secretary speak with Secretary Mattis today? I know they speak frequently, and did they discuss this in particular?
I believe, let me double check the schedule, but I seem to recall that Secretary Mattis and Secretary Tillerson met early this morning.
And did they discuss this in particular, these rumors?
Again, let me take a double check the schedule about that, but I believe it was early this morning that they met. Again, this morning, that was before this news broke.
Could you check also to see if Secretary Tillerson spoke with General Kelly when he was at the White House?
I told you, they did speak when they were at the White House.
At the White House, sorry.
Yes. Hold on. Okay, hold on. Go ahead, Josh.
Can you tell us whether, based on the divestiture agreement that the Secretary entered with the Government Ethics Office, whether he would face any tax or financial implications if he were to leave, particularly if he were to leave before the one-year mark? Okay.
I've seen that story. I'm certainly aware of that report. A lot of people have started to ask about that. I have no knowledge of how that financial situation would work. I can certainly look into it. I'm not sure I'm going to have an answer for you. However, I have spoken with various reputable news organizations. I won't name them, but some of them are in the room today who have all said that they've run down that story and have found no basis in fact for that. But again, that's based on what reporters here in the room have told me about that story. Okay. We're going to stay with this before we go into that.
It's a follow up on the embassies.
Yes.
Some embassies in some Muslim countries enhanced their security protocols since yesterday and those tweets.
We would never address security protocols that either have or have not changed at our embassy. That's something that we keep close to the vest here at the State Department. We have talked about this the other day, a brand new assistant secretary for diplomatic security who has a very big job, not only overseeing our more than 2,000 diplomatic security agents who work for the State Department, but also our locally employed staff who are security officials who help protect our embassies. And by the way, we have the Marines out there as well. In terms of changing our security posture, that's just not something we're going to get into. Okay. Anything else on that? Okay.
Hey,
Gardner.
Josh's point. Don't these rumors and these stories, which have now been reported widely by many different outlets, don't they make the secretary's job very challenging? Because won't his counterparts in Europe next week be asking themselves who Tillerson is speaking for? Because these stories suggest that he no longer speaks for the president or has the president's confidence.
Look, I can tell you this. After meeting with the foreign minister of Germany today, and then the story broke as we were emerging from that meeting with the German foreign minister. Fast forward a couple hours, and I see an AFP report that talks about one of the issues that came up in the meeting with the foreign minister of Germany, and that is Germany's decision to reduce its diplomatic mission in Pyongyang and require North Korea to reduce its presence in Berlin. That is a subject that came up today between the secretary and the foreign minister. That is something that is a part of our maximum pressure campaign to take money out of North Korea, to try to choke off the money that goes into North Korea, that goes into its ballistic and nuclear programs. The reason I mentioned this, Gardner, is that this story came out after that meeting. This story came out a few hours later. That is important and that is significant because the foreign minister made this decision, put that information out there after this news broke. What I'm saying is that the secretary has his position. He is the secretary of state. He will continue with that position, continue doing his job, continue doing his duty and serving the American public until the president, you know, if and when the president decides that he no longer wants to keep the secretary in his position. Okay? Yes.
Yes. That you keep mentioning that you cannot share with us the diplomatic conversations. But if you see the top level, president and the prime minister of the UK are talking directly on the Twitter. And so what else is left to not to be shared with us?
Well, that would be between those the governments. You mean the president and UK? I can't speak for the president, and I certainly can't speak for the British Prime Minister.
What else is left? At what level there are more?
I'm sure I'm not following your question. Are you suggesting that the only conversations that take place between world leaders is on Twitter?
No, I'm talking about the department. Are the departments having a conversation to do the damage control?
I'm sorry, I'm not understanding your question.
When the president tweets and the UK prime minister replies and then the president replies,
yes,
there is a level of conversation going on. And then you say that there are also conversations at the lower levels or other levels which you cannot share with us because they are private.
Sir, nothing has changed. Often we do not discuss the contents of our diplomatic conversation. I mean, you'll hear many of your colleagues here complaining about that. There are some things that we choose to keep private. That hasn't changed. But I can't comment on the conversations that the White House is having with other nations. Okay?
All the way back,
okay.
Please.
Hi, what are you doing all the way back there?
Well, I came in late, so I didn't want to
disturb
you. Well,
that's very polite of you. Good to see you.
So could you give us a little more detail about the call that was taken from General Kelly, and you say that he told, I guess, the Secretary of State that these reports aren't true. Could you talk about what else he said, how he explained the fact that every major news organization was reporting this out of the White House today?
I'm not going to characterize what Chief of Staff Kelly what exactly he said. I think that would be for General Kelly to explain himself. But I know that he did place a phone call this morning and say that there was nothing to that report of having a plan in place.
He spoke with who?
I told you that. I already told you that. He spoke with our chief of staff this morning. Yes. Okay. Okay. Hi, sir.
I have a question about Nord Stream 2.
You know, why don't we do this? Let's get through these stories and then I will come back to you, okay?
Okay, thank you.
Anything else on this issue? Okay, we'll change topic then. Okay, we'll go to Nord Stream 2.
Nord Stream 2.
And I'm sorry, you're with
me. I'm Marek Walkowski, Polish Public Radio.
Okay, nice to meet you. Welcome to the State Department.
Deputy Assistant Secretary McCarrick told a group of European journalists that, I quote, "We don't see the possibility that Nord Stream 2 is going to be built. That's not something that we are going to assume is going to happen." Could you explain what is the statement based on? And I'm wondering if the topic has been discussed during the meeting between Secretary Tillerson and German Foreign Minister, and what's the conclusion of their discussion, if in fact it was one of the topics.
Yeah, I can tell you that that conversation did not come up. The Secretary and the Foreign Minister had a very positive meeting in which they talked about the DPRK, North Korea. They talked about the humanitarian crisis in Yemen and the importance of Saudi Arabia opening additional ports and ways that we can get humanitarian aid into Yemen. They talked about a few other matters as well. Nord Stream 2 was not one of the topics that came up in my presence. Now, they may have had a separate sideline conversation that I did not witness, so that may have come up. In terms of where exactly we are on Nord Stream 2, pardon me one second. Another topic related to that is the multi-line Turkish stream, as I understand it. So our position on this would be that Europe is certainly working to try to diversify where it gets its energy. I've spoken with some of your colleagues before, people from that part of the world as well, and recognizing that there should be and could be more sources of energy. We have seen in the very cold winter months where Vladimir Putin, which is where a lot of your energy comes from, in particular in Poland, where he will turn off those energy supplies, causing costs to go up and causing people to lose heat on occasion. So we know that Europe is working to diversify its energy sector overall. It's also assessing projects that would undermine some of these efforts. We agree with many of our European partners that Nord Stream 2 and a multi-line Turkish stream would reinforce Russian dominance in Europe's gas markets. It would reduce opportunities for diversification of energy sources. It would pose security risks in an already tense Baltic Sea region. And it would advance Russia's goal of undermining Ukraine, that's a particular concern of ours, by ending Ukraine's role as a transit country for Russian gas exports to get to Europe. Construction of Nord Stream 2 would concentrate about 75% of Russian gas imports to the EU through a single route, creating a potential checkpoint that would significantly increase Europe's vulnerability to a supply disruption. So we believe that these two projects would enable Gazprom to cut off transit via Ukraine and still meet demand in Western Europe, which would economically undermine Ukraine by depriving it of about $2 billion in annual transit revenue.
But okay? Is the statement correct that you don't believe that the project would be built, that the Nord Stream 2 would be built? And Secretary Tillerson called recently the Nord Stream 2 unwise. What are you doing to stop this unwise project?
So, sir, I don't have the Secretary's comments in front of me, so I hesitate to comment on having something.
2 days
that
ago at the Woodrow Wilson Center.
I understand. I just don't have the exact quote in front of me, so I'm just not going to comment on that. And the other person who made a remark, I'm afraid I don't have that with me either. So, okay?
Yes.
Thanks. Yeah, North Korea.
Yesterday, in a briefing you gave, you specifically called on Germany to withdraw its ambassador from North Korea.
That was misreported. I'd like to go back, and if you want to check the transcript, actually, I did not call on Germany to get rid of its ambassador. What we did, and what we often do, as you've heard me many times here before, is call upon countries to do a lot more. To do a lot more, which could include kicking out an ambassador. It could include reducing the size of the footprint of that country. It could include reducing the number of North Korean guest workers. There were some reporters who misreported that, so I just want to make that clear.
The quote, if maybe this isn't accurate, but you said, we would continue to ask Germany or other countries around the world to recall those ambassadors. Mm-hmm. Shrink the footprint of the size of the entity that North Korea has in any given country. I mean, so when
that,
you said
that is nothing new. We ask
to recall those ambassadors.
We ask a lot of those countries to do that type of thing. Certainly.
Okay. So did the secretary today ask the foreign minister of Germany to recall his
the secretary
ambassador?
Did not specifically ask that, but the conversation did come up, and that's why I mentioned that AFP story that came out earlier today that said that they would. Just go back and double check it, but that they would, I believe they said, reduce the size of their footprint,
reduce its
diplomatic commission.
Was he disappointed that the Germans have not recalled their ambassador. I mean, Nikki Haley yesterday was very explicit at the UN. They want countries around the world to completely cut off diplomatic ties with North Korea. Germany is saying, essentially, sure, we'll reduce staff, but we're going to leave this embassy open.
I think this is a success. The news that we have seen come out of Germany, as with many other nations, we've seen this with Peru, we've seen it with Japan, we've seen it with South Korea, we've seen it with Sudan, where Sudan has recently said that it's no longer going to buy weapons from the DPRK. That is all a part of our maximum pressure campaign. That maximum pressure campaign, which you all probably get tired of hearing me talk about, is something that we is our top national security priority here. Nations continue to get on board and support that. We have well north of 20 countries who have done different things to jump on board with that campaign. And I think the news that's coming out of Germany today is altogether positive.
Okay. Hold on.
Can you sort of again be explicit? Do you want all of your allies to end diplomatic ties, withdraw their ambassadors from Pyongyang? Because we're hearing from your allies, from U.S. allies, that they have no intention of withdrawing their ambassadors, and that in their conversations with the Trump administration is not asking them to withdraw their ambassadors or end diplomatic ties. So what are you asking them specifically to do?
Well, one of the things that we have talked about here in this administration is the importance of sovereign nations, right? So nations have the ability to make the choices that are best or that they believe are best for their nations. However, we all, civilized nations, recognize the constant and pervasive threat of the DPRK. We saw what just happened 2 days ago with what we believe may have been an intercontinental ballistic missile launch, in addition to the other launches that North Korea has conducted and the advanced nuclear testing that they conducted just a few months ago. So we have seen all of that. The world recognizes what a regional and global threat North Korea is, that North Korea presents. So many countries in the world are on board with this campaign, on board with the maximum pressure campaign. But countries have to make their own decisions about what will work best for them.
What is the campaign? Do you want them to all close their embassies and withdraw all their diplomatic personnel from Pyongyang?
I can give you transcript and transcript and transcript of the briefings from here, Gardner, or from the Secretary Tillerson's meetings about our maximum pressure campaign. I can briefly go over it once again. Sorry, you all have heard
no,
it.
No, just the ambassador.
You all have heard it a million
times. Because
they're
telling us that you, they're not hearing from you that they want, that you want their missions to be shuttered and all their ambassadors withdrawn.
I have not heard from any particular ambassadors with that question. I've not gotten that question from any particular ambassadors. If we do and I know about it, I can certainly let you know, but we've not gotten that question so far.
But you want them to all withdraw their ambassadors, is that right?
Here's what I would say, and I'm not in the position to make policy, so I am not going to do that. But a key part of our maximum pressure campaign is to ask other nations, and again, let me underscore that countries are all sovereign. Okay, they need to do what they feel is in their best interest. That is something that this administration recognizes. But we ask countries to choke off the money supply that goes into North Korea. We know for a fact that North Korea doesn't use the money that comes into its government or to its people for the benefit of its people. They don't feed their people. They have people starving, malnourished. We've all seen that. You've seen intestinal problems that the soldier who just escaped from North Korea has certainly had, all of that. So we know the money doesn't go to the people. We know the money goes to its illegal weapons programs. So we have called on countries across the world to join us in that maximum pressure campaign in reducing the size of their missions in North Korea. If they would be willing to close their missions in North Korea altogether, I think that is something that we would be supportive of. We've also called on nations to kick out North Korean guest workers, to reduce the size of North Korean missions in their own countries. It's a broad pressure campaign. We also have unilateral sanctions and all of that, in addition to the UN Security Council resolutions. Okay, let's move on.
Thank you, Heather. Let me just ask you very quickly, today marks the end of the 6 month waiver for maintaining your embassy in Tel Aviv and moving it to Jerusalem. Do you have any news on that? Is the president going to likely sign another waiver for another 6 months?
I know. Everyone would like to speculate about that.
You know, what is your position?
So I can just tell you that no decision has been made on that matter yet. My understanding is that the waiver is actually due to Congress by December 4th, which would be
Monday.
Monday. Yeah. Okay. I think you said today. Yeah. You know, the president has said that he's given serious consideration to the matter, and we're looking at it with great care. That's all I have for you on that.
Okay. Is the secretary talking to the president on this issue? Because in past administrations, the Secretary of State always presented the case as to why this would be a bad decision for the United States at this particular time.
I know that
there's some sort of, you know, process ongoing.
Yeah, the Secretary is talking to the White House about that matter, and I know we're having a lot of conversations about that as well. But again, I want to underscore that no decision has been made yet.
And one last question. When you determined that the office of the PLO must remain open, you said that we want to limit their activity to the peace process. Mm-hmm. Does that include the movement of the ambassador and his staff, let's say when they are called by the Palestinian American community in San Francisco to speak or anything? How do you limit their activities to that particular area?
I'm not aware of that particular scenario that you outlined.
Right.
That is not one that I had heard of.
Okay. But you're saying that it's optimistic, that you are optimistic in 90 days or in 3 months, the situation will be such that we would allow the office to remain operational fully. But also you say that they must limit their activities to the peace process. What does that mean?
Okay. So we have advised the PLO office to limit its activities to those related to achieving a lasting, comprehensive peace between the Israelis and the Palestinians. We're actively involved in restarting what we consider to be substantial Israeli-Palestinian negotiations. We have found, and we talked about this coming out of the UN General Assembly, both parties have been cooperative. The conversations have been constructive. And we believe that both sides are prepared to engage in negotiations. The statute that you reference provides that if after 90 days the president determines that the Palestinians are engaged in direct and meaningful negotiations with Israel, restrictions on the PLO and its Washington office may be lifted. You reference this also. We remain optimistic that at the end of that 90-day period, the political process may be sufficiently advanced and that the president will be in the position to allow the PLO office to resume full operation.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.
Hello and welcome to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter LaBelle. Bitcoin, for some, it's the perfect marriage of technology and finance. For others, it's a get-rich scheme. Though no one can deny its market value is soaring and becoming an attractive alternative to the current global banking system. Is Bitcoin revolutionizing the world? Crosstalking Bitcoin, I'm joined by my guest, Mitch Feierstein in New York. He is a fund manager and author of the book Planet Ponzi. In Atlantic, we have Jeffrey Tucker. He is director of content for the Foundation for Economic Education. And in Cambridge, we cross to Garrick Heilman. He is a research fellow at the University of Cambridge. All right, gentlemen, Crosstalk rules in effect. That means you can jump in anytime you want, and I always appreciate it. Garrick, let me go to you first in Cambridge. Explain what is going on with Bitcoin. I mean, I'm of the age, and I used to work in finance. I can remember the dot-com bubble and then its meltdown here. Not being very well versed in Bitcoin, what is going on here? Is this just speculation, or is this the new shiny, radiant future? Go ahead in Cambridge.
Right. Well, I think a little bit of both, to be honest. And certainly we've seen, you know, some aspects of this story before, as you mentioned. You know, after the dot-com bubble exploded in 2000, 2001, there were a number of winners that emerged from that era, and a number of new companies that were born after that have done quite well. You know, Bitcoin has already been declared dead several times in 2011. Mm-hmm. Wired wrote an article saying the rise and fall of Bitcoin. We saw the crash in 2014, yet it keeps coming back. So it wouldn't surprise me if we have another crash, maybe a few more in front of us. But it does seem that there's something important happening here with regards to the future of finance, the future of money.
Yeah, well, at least for a small number of people, they become, at least, I guess, technically in the cloud somewhere, fabulously rich. It's really an amazing story. Jeffrey, I mean, Garrett called this, I think, in an article, a minor miracle. Would you use the word miracle here? Let me go to Jeffrey in Atlantic.
Yeah, I read that article, and I appreciate that term, actually. It kind of is. Nobody ever thought anything like this was possible before 2008, before the white paper of October 2008. We didn't really have the means to do what the blockchain does today. Just for background, blockchain is the real underlying technology of Bitcoin and the real reason for its value. Bitcoin is just an expression of that technological value. And blockchain allows us to do something we've always wanted to do since the ancient world, but never had the ability to do it. But thanks to these distributed networks and cryptography, we can do it now.
You know, Mitch, I guess Jeffrey kind of put it in succinctly for me, because, you know, I was in finance for a number of years, and there's always, you know, what's it backed up by? You know, what are the assets? You know, you always look at that. And then, but what Jeffrey just said there kind of explains it. It's the technology is the safety. That's what's backing it up here. Do you buy that? Because, you know, you can say this is a scheme, it's a get rich, but I mean, there's something to it, and people are making money here, and it makes everyone interested to get involved in it if you have the means. Go ahead, Mitch. How do you explain it all?
Well, I mean, we need perspective, I think. Bitcoin has come about in a time where the central banks, reckless central bank policy around the world has distorted every market. And too much credit, too much debt, and too much leverage have created instability in the financial markets. So we need to add perspective. So we need to look at risk versus reward with Bitcoin and the Bitcoin trade. So Bitcoin has gigantic volatility. You're seeing 30% moves either way in a day or 40% moves. So it's not for the faint of heart. So, you know, my perspective from an investor and being in the banking community internationally for 38 years, you look at the iconic figures like Jamie Dimon, who said it's a Ponzi scheme and it's going to zero.
Right.
He's totally wrong. But the establishment banks and the way that the fractional banking system works, people want to escape from that. People want to escape from the establishment. But what we've got going on here, just to be clear, is we've got inflation in every asset class. Stocks are trading at stratospheric valuations. Apple has a market cap eclipsing $1 trillion. Facebook at $600 billion. So if you look yesterday, recently, you saw a pullback in the NASDAQ, the FANG stocks, Facebook, Apple, and all the technology issues. They lost $60 billion in market cap in a day, where the market cap of Bitcoin is what, around $160 billion. So on a relative basis, it's a much smaller move, and it's a very emerging market. So I think we've got to look at where we are. And it's an alternative asset class. I mean, you're looking at art. A Leonardo da Vinci painting traded at $450 million.
Right.
So, I mean, we need to put it into the proper historical perspective. Now, stocks are way overvalued, so are bonds, and so is property. So people are looking to get out of the dollar system, and I happen to agree you need to diversify, but I think you should also get some precious metals, gold and silver, which have been currencies for 6,000 years. Dollar is backed by fundamentally nothing.
Nothing. Okay, let me go back to Cambridge. I mean, there's a lot of people are saying that large investors are getting interested in Bitcoin. Is that distorting the price? Because they have the deep pockets at this price level to get into the market. Is there something behind that there? Because having been in finance, I mean, this is speculation, okay? I mean, people are not buying on facts. They're buying on speculation right now. Go ahead, Garrett, in Cambridge.
Right. I think certainly the hedge funds, the big whales that are coming in, the billionaires we read about, are certainly influencing the price direction. But I think there's still a lot of money on the sidelines. I was at a hedge fund conference recently, and less than 20% of the funds in the room, and there are some pretty big funds in the room, have taken a step into this space. And I think the ones that have, a lot of them have done so as individuals rather than putting their funds in, because, you know, it's still very difficult to short Bitcoin.
Yep.
There's major counterparty risk. A lot of the exchanges, cryptocurrency exchanges, won't do things like reveal their financials, their audited financials to funds. So things that, you know, hedge funds are used to having in typical markets they trade in are not in place yet here, but they're coming. If CME, NASDAQ do come into the market with futures platforms, you know, if things like ETFs and, you know, other things roll out, bring more regulation to the space, then I think you will see even more hedge funds come in, and the price, you know, could go either way, frankly. I think the investment playing field has been a bit lopsided in favor of the bulls, and that could level. And a lot of the hedge fund guys aren't passionate about crypto. And frankly, they would probably, I think, from a psychological perspective, prefer to make money if Bitcoin crashes on the way down than going up. That would certainly help them rationalize their lateness to the market.
You know, Jeffrey, it's very interesting is that I think one of the interesting phenomenons about Bitcoin is its lack of regulation, and going back what Mitch had to say here. And we have to remember this phenomenon came into being after the financial crisis of 2008, which the banks were responsible for. And so is this an element of that here? Because that the freedom of here, go ahead, jump in, go ahead.
Yeah, no, there certainly is. I think of the success of Bitcoin is in part attributable to the fact that it has not been managed from the center. It's not been regulated, and that allows a lot of innovation and for people to try out things. You know, you want to talk about market caps. You can talk about $150 billion for Bitcoin, but really you have to look at the whole class of crypto assets right now. And you're looking at, last I checked, it was about $350 billion once you include all the various tokenized blockchains that are out there, all the various Ethereum applications, the various altcoins. And we're just beginning to see these. We're going to see things coming up within the next year, like these Lightning networks that are going to be used for small transactions that are going to fix the prevailing problems that exist in Bitcoin, which is that the networks are vastly clogged right now. Mm-hmm. It's very expensive to send and receive Bitcoin. It's growing so hard, so fast, that it's almost become unusable just by itself for regular small transactions.
Investors are
looking for things like hedge funds.
Yeah, that's the reason why I never really got into it, because it's just not easy to move around. At least I'm not adept at doing those kind of things here. You know, Mitch, a lot of people are saying that this whole thing with Bitcoin, it's really just an investment. It's not really a mechanism to buy and sell. It is to park your money somewhere and leave it there because you don't trust the banks. I mean, for it to be really universal, you have to be able to use your wallet, as they call it, and buy things and sell things. It's not that easy to do. It's not widely accepted, though many more innovative people do say they accept it. Go ahead, Mitch.
It's part of a diversification strategy where you'd have some Bitcoin and just sit on it and not worry about what your basis was, and whatever the losses are, you're going to eat the losses, and if you get a profit out of it, fine. But, you know, when you have that much volatility, you know, I disagree that the big hedge funds will get involved in this when you have a 30% volatility swing each direction. So from peak to trough and back up again, down and up again, I mean, no investor wants to tolerate that kind of volatility. And how can you manage that kind of volatility becomes very difficult. So are the hedge funds and the banks going to jump in head first up at these levels? Probably not. If we get a bit more stability into these markets, you'll see more investment. But also, from that risk-reward perspective, you've also got to keep in mind that this is a non-regulated market. That's the attractiveness from people.
Right.
But governments have overreach, like we're seeing in the media right now. The deep state runs America. They're trying to rewrite history here with these statue wars. And that's always a dangerous time. So if too many people get on the Bitcoin train and get on the crypto train, the government could come in one day and say it's illegal in this country. We're cracking down on everybody. Because right now, when you open up an account, they demand the KYC, know your customer information. And they will, when it becomes bigger, they will try to regulate it and they will try to control it. It's difficult for the government to let anything come out of its grasp. The Federal Reserve prints willy-nilly trillions and trillions of dollars since we went off the gold standard, backed by nothing. Now, this is a Ponzi scheme. The government, that's what my book is about, the government debt globally is a Ponzi scheme. The governments can never repay this debt, and we're about to hit a wall. So should people invest in alternative asset classes? Absolutely. Is a Leonardo da Vinci painting worth $500 million? Is an apartment in Midtown Manhattan worth $600 million? I would argue no, it's not.
I would agree.
Tuition prices from when I went to university have gone up 2,000%.
Yep.
Where real wages since the 1980s are flat. Right. So how does that work out? When I got out of school, I could have bought a two-bedroom apartment.
Mitch, let me jump in here. Gentlemen, I have to go to a break, and after that short break, we'll continue our discussion on Bitcoin. Stay with RT.
You're listening to Weekday World from CPR.
Gary, let me go back to you in Cambridge. While it is a fascinating concept, these cryptocurrencies, there is the concern of accountability. You know, illegal drugs, arms, and other kinds of illegal activity can stay under the radar of the authorities. I mean, I think that's a kind of a downside. Also, you know, when people talk about it as being a new fiat currency one day, I mean, you know, people are buying big ticket items because they are avoiding taxation and things like that. So, I mean, it kind of cuts both ways here. I guess really the most important question will be if this kinds of cryptocurrencies are successful, what is the temptation of governments to step in to regulate it, and would regulation kill it? Go ahead.
Right. You know, it's been very interesting to watch the migration of regulatory interest across the space. I mean, first we had law enforcement with the rise of the Silk Road and the online dark web, its use of Bitcoin, taking interest in the sector. More recently, securities regulators, and with the upswing in prices, I'm sure tax authorities are kind of next in line to start getting involved. With regards to the law enforcement question, you know, it's a double-edged sword for law enforcement because on the one hand, these currencies do enable privacy on dark web transactions. But on the other hand, law enforcement, when they catch a criminal who's been using Bitcoin and they get a hold of their wallet software, they get effectively their books, and they may have a good chance of recovering some of the funds. And that's not something you get with a cash criminal where there isn't record keeping. So you can use the blockchain to prosecute cases, and that has been done. And law enforcement, I think, at least in some jurisdictions, is steadily becoming more open to seeing crime committed with blockchain technology. It does give them an advantage over cash crime.
Okay, it's a very transparent technology. That's an amazing plus for it. Jeffrey, earlier this week, there was a San Francisco judge putting pressure on a company that trades in these commodities and these currencies here. They want to see their books. They want to see names. They want to see transactions here. What kind of threat is that to Bitcoin? Or can Bitcoin evolve with this kind of supervision and regulation from the outside? Because my sense is, and maybe you can correct me if I'm wrong, the people that started this whole thing don't like the state, they don't like authority, they really want to be on their own here. We're going to see an encroachment on this on these kinds of currencies and you know, alternative financial mechanisms. Go ahead.
You know, the regulation of the exchanges began in the spring of 2013. So far as I'm concerned, it was a disaster. We would have been much further along without these regulations. This is the main way the government can control Bitcoin. It's not actually controlling Bitcoin. What they're doing is controlling the traffic between national monies and crypto assets coming and going. They can control that. And the U.S. has some of the worst regulations in the world on crypto assets right now, on these exchanges.
Well, I mean, but, why is that? You know, Jeffrey, why
these,
is
these
that?
These markets are global.
Why is that? Why is that situation exists in the U.S.?
Well, because the regulators are trying to force a modern digital technology into an analog, old-world-style regulatory framework, and it's not working. And all it's doing is driving the innovation out of this country into other places. You know, you can buy Bitcoin much easier in a place like Israel than you can in the United States or in Brazil. You know, I've been to exchanges all over the world. Most of them are very free and easy, and there's a lot of entrepreneurship there. In the U.S., it's all about command and control. It's a huge mistake for American regulators to be taking this direction because they're just going to drive the innovation and the capital outside the borders. Bitcoin and crypto assets in general are global technologies. Yeah, they don't care about the nation state.
Okay, Mitch, you know, address that issue there, because, I mean, the almighty dollar, it's a threat to, you know, Bitcoin and all these other things are a threat to the global domination of the dollar. Obviously something the U.S. doesn't want to have happen.
Right. I mean, we're talking about U.S. dollar hegemony. And, you know, my view is the days of U.S. dollar hegemony are very limited. Look, before the United States became the reserve currency, I think in 1913, when they created the Federal Reserve, which is a disaster that should be shuttered, the British sterling was the reserve currency of the world for 300 years. Now, was the United States responsible with the petrodollar and going off the gold standard in the Nixon era? I would argue no. I would argue that this has caused market distortion. I would argue that the central bank policies in the last 10 years have been more destructive than the good that they've provided, because I don't see that we've created growth for the trillions of dollars in debt that we've created. Now, as we saw in the last administration in Washington, big government is in right now. So our government is gargantuan, and they want overreach with everything in every part of people's lives in America. And to do that, if you get an iron fist on the banking system and make people take away cash, like one of the professors at Harvard wrote a book to get rid of all cash, make people put their money into the bank. This is a very dangerous thing. That's why people are migrating to other platforms. So we're at a point in time in history that could be very pivotal as to how we move forward with this. But the media is controlled. And if you look at regulation, they don't regulate companies like Amazon that dips their fingers into everything and every different business, or Facebook or Google that have become oligarchies. Right. And basically they're controlling the content that everybody sees. And this is where the regulatory agency should be looking, not to control people's currency movements or whether they want to buy gold or invest a bit in Bitcoin. They should look at controlling the Facebooks, the Googles, and looking at news, the news entities, because news in this country has become opinion and political advocacy. Yeah. And this is a way for the liberal left to rewrite history, which is extremely dangerous. If we look, Mark Thompson, who ran BBC during the Jimmy Savile pedophile scandal, snuck out of London and came to run the New York Times. And people forget about history and where people are and how they move around, but the same establishment figures are running things. Well, 160 companies used to control the media, now it's down to 6.
Yeah. Gary, one of the things back in Cambridge, one of the things I find appealing about Bitcoin, and I can't say that I'm an expert on it by a long shot, it seems to promote entrepreneurship, which I think is a really good thing. Again, you know, people that want to get out of the system, away from the system, away from regulation. Is it fair to say that these cryptocurrencies would be good for innovation?
I think absolutely. I don't think anyone doubts that. And I think actually, you know, I think people can argue about how bad the regulation is. But in certain markets, there's been a very pro-cryptocurrency attitude because of the innovative aspects of it. And people are taking a much lighter touch in Switzerland and in the UK even and elsewhere because of the amount of investment that's coming in, because of the, you know, faster, cheaper, better ways we can do things with this technology. And not just the technology itself, but also the new funding channels that are opening up. I mean, the ICO phenomenon, which we haven't really talked about, is on the one hand scary because there are some projects out there that, you know, clearly are fraudulent. But at the same time, you're also opening up access to early stage technology, to seed stage technology, to anyone around the world with an internet connection. This used to be something you had to be a rich VC to be able to do. Now, if you have a computer, have a little cryptocurrency, you can invest in early stage technology. That has a lot of risks, and it also has a lot of opportunities. It's personally, for me, I think, an exciting part of this story.
You know, Mitch, you know.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up.
Oh, okay. Jeffrey, go ahead. Jump in.
Yeah, no, I'm glad you brought up this point about the ICO, because they've been kind of smeared in the financial press as being, just scams. And it's true, there's some rackets out there. But truth is that this is an amazing innovation. That it allows people to raise, any business to raise money from anybody without using any financial intermediaries. I mean, the amount of innovation and capital that's going to unleash on the planet Earth is beyond belief. I mean, it's inconceivable what the ICO market could do to transform the nature of capital markets themselves over the next 10 years. Yeah.
Mitch, go ahead, jump in.
The issue with the ICO market, as I see it, it's an exciting market, but it's the wild, wild west in early days. And what's going to happen is the propaganda bullhorns of the media and advocates for the JP Morgans and the Goldmans who are being infringed upon when these offerings come out, and they're not going to get their fees. So what will happen is they'll make an example out of one that fails, like the media does. They'll have, blow it up into a epic proportion. This is bad. You're going to get ripped off. Don't do this. Give us your money. Only invest through something that we vet for you. So, yeah, there will be winners and losers. And you have to keep the perspective. Like I said at the beginning, there's perspective and risk and reward. And don't go out and mortgage your house and put everything into Bitcoin or an ICO. But look, you look at this as a portion of your portfolio and have a diversification in your portfolio. And when you go into a high risk thing like an ICO, do your due diligence, do your own homework. And like I say in my book, don't ever invest in anything that you don't fully understand. If you don't fully understand it and you invest in it, then you deserve to lose what you lose. But if you give it your best, don't put all your money into it. Don't put all your eggs in one basket. Diversify, put a little bit into it. And if you take a loss on that and you make a profit somewhere else, then you can balance out. But your payout with some of these is going to be exponential, as we've witnessed before. The problem comes in when you try to harness the volatility.
Okay, Gary, let me go back to you, Cambridge, give you the last word here. What does Bitcoin and similar currencies, what do they have to do to create confidence in people that just see it as too risky? What maybe one or two steps they need to install?
Well, I think, similar to the mid to late 90s during the dot-com kind of run-up, we're in the infrastructure building phase for cryptocurrency and crypto assets. I mean, yesterday we had three major exchanges experience significant problems. Two of those exchanges are going to be relied upon by CME for their futures market. That simply can't happen, on a regular basis like it does for this market to be taken seriously by institutions, to be trusted by a broader class of individuals. So more capital markets infrastructure is needed. The right balance of regulation is needed. And I think people absolutely need to understand that this is still very early stage, very volatile. I agree with the comments that have been made about only put into this what you can afford to lose, because it is still very high risk.
Okay, well, it's been an interesting ride. I'm sure we're going to see a lot more ahead. That's all the time we have, gentlemen. Many thanks to my guests in New York, Atlanta, and in Cambridge. And thanks to our viewers for watching us here at RT. See you next time. And remember, Crosstalk rules.
You're listening to Weekday World from CPR, Community Public Radio. I'm your host, Don DeBar.